You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help.
Welcome, everyone, to Curator's Corner. If this is your first time joining us for any of our programs, a special welcome to you. If indeed this is the first time you've done anything with the Spy Museum, check out our website for all the great adult programming and even youth programming that we're doing throughout this end of the summer and into the fall. A lot of great things to keep yourself occupied during this pandemic. We are in a pretty extraordinary situation this year, regardless of all the crazy that's happened otherwise, because we are marking the 75th anniversary of a pretty momentous moment, really, the end of World War II. We've had a lot of really key dates throughout this year, going from May and VE Day to all the different nuclear stuff from Trinity to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Soon we'll be celebrating the formal end of World War II in the beginning of September. But another thing that is celebrating its 75th anniversary is the State Department Intelligence Branch, the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, which a lot of you perhaps may not have heard a lot about. Perhaps you don't know of them at all, but they are, as you can tell, older than CIA, older than NSA, DIA, actually the vast majority of intelligence agencies as part of the IC. INR is one of the first. So why don't we hear about them a lot? There's not a lot of movies about INR agents running around the world, saving the day. They don't tend to crow a lot, but today we're going to give them the opportunity to brag a little bit about themselves because they deserve it after 75 years. So we're joined by an extraordinary panel, including the boss herself. We have the Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, Ellen McCarthy, who's joining us. We also have the Director of the Office of Cyber Affairs, Benjamin Brake, who's, I have to say, all his buddies call him Benjamin. We had to make sure we've got that in there. We have the Science and Global Health Advisor to INR, Dr. Adrian Keene. And finally, the Director of the Office of Opinion and Research at INR, Regina Ferranda. So thank you all for joining us. This is going to be a really interesting panel. We really haven't had the opportunity to reach out and talk to you guys very much. And so I think we have the best four we could possibly ask for, certainly here. So Assistant Secretary McCarthy, let me start with you because, like I said, you don't necessarily hear a lot about INR. I think that's on purpose. You know, you kind of keep your head down and keep quiet and do your job. But for the audience out there who may not be as familiar with INR as some of us are, can you talk a little bit about your place within the IC? What does INR provide to the broader intelligence community and American national security writ large? Like, what is your claim to fame at INR?
So first of all, call me Ellen. Although every time I hear Assistant Secretary, it gives me the shakes because I would never have thought. I started in the intelligence community in the mid 80s. And if somebody had told me then that someday you would get to come and work in INR, I would have said you're crazy. Because INR just has had, for those of us who've worked in the IC, INR is very well known, actually. You know, it has a long reputation for excellence and being the really smart kids and, being the ones who had deep knowledge, deep expertise, would spend years in an area or a function. And so you know, when given the chance to come and work with these folks, it was, you don't say no to those sorts of opportunities. But I'll tell you, I really was surprised at all that INR does, even I, who've been around for a while. And by the way, you should always know that the second you think you know, you are hosed. I mean, seriously, I had no idea all the things that INR does. We are the State Department's intelligence agency. We not only are we one of 40 bureaus within state, but we're also one of 16 intelligence agencies. So we operate and we report to the Director of National Intelligence, just like CIA and DIA and all the agencies that I'm sure many of your bureaus are very familiar with. But what sets us apart from all of those intelligence agencies is we're the only one that supports the Secretary of State and his team, both inside Maine State and spread around the world that are at the posts. We are the only ones whose whole reason for existence is to inform policymaking and to ensure that not only are we leveraging the work that all the other agencies are doing, but we are executing our own expertise that comes from operating day-to-day with policymakers, being completely integrated with their operations, developing those relationships. We have 20% of our staff is foreign service, so we truly understand the needs of the policymaker, and we have a level of expertise that you won't find anywhere else across the IC. So that, in a nutshell, is who INR is, and we are super cool. And when I get out of this job, I plan on producing a movie, and some of these folks on the screen will be in that movie.
Not sure there'll be a lot of parachuting in that movie or anything, but it'll be. I'll watch it. I'll definitely watch it. So the most probably person that's been very busy, I would think, over the last 6 or 7 months is Adrian. As the, you know, Global Health Science Advisor, you've probably had your hands full with, you know, there is a global, in case you haven't been paying attention, there's a global pandemic. And, you know, you the State Department, more than anyone else, has its hands tied to global cooperation and internationalism. So I'm wondering how much, in two cents, how much you've had to, how much your job has gotten busier, certainly over the last 6 months, but also the opportunities that have opened up for cooperation in with other countries that maybe we wouldn't have dealt with before over this idea of how can we come together and do something about the COVID-19 outbreak.
Well, thanks for that question. And I'm really excited to be here and talk about the science because I'm a scientist by training. So that subject is near and dear to my heart. So yes, I've been very, very busy over the last 6 months. It feels like at least a decade ago when it was actually December 31st when I first learned of the outbreak, when the world learned of the outbreak through a few infectious disease monitoring listservs and things. So I've been really busy since that time. It's been really a ton of work, but it's also been pretty gratifying as a scientist to see all the international science output during this crisis. And it's been so important to our work. Science advances in general, but of course during this crisis have been so important to understanding the foreign policy implications and national security implications of these sorts of crises. So that's been, really, really important to our work. And the thing is, there has been such a volume that you've got to kind of filter through the science too, right? So we, I spend a lot of my time trying to evaluate what type of science is actually helpful and what kind of science we're going to put in front of our senior policymakers. And then, of course, we combine that with the intelligence reporting and diplomatic reporting from our diplomats out overseas to provide the fullest picture we can for our senior policymakers. So yes, we've done a lot of that. But we also have relationships. I mean, the great thing about INR is because we're, part of the State Department and we don't do any intelligence collection. So, we're all overt analysts. We're able to reach out and maintain relationships with scientists all over the world and in the U.S. and get their thoughts on crises like this. So we ask for their input directly. We go to conferences and things like that, and then also have some more formal relationships, even like asking them to do research projects for us, bringing them in for analytic outreach events where we can ask them kind of behind closed doors, so with policymakers, with us in the intelligence community, ask them questions about their science and their views on scientific issues. So we've done that multiple times throughout this crisis. And then as far as the international cooperation side, I really don't have a whole lot to say on that. So we are, as Ellen said, in INR, we are supporting the policymakers. So we're providing them the analysis and information. And so I'll kind of leave that. I would leave that to my broader State Department colleagues for that question. Yeah.
Right. Well, Ben, let me ask you a similar question, because it's not a new issue like the pandemic is, but because cyber affects everyone on Earth, anyone who's connected at all to the internet, and countries perhaps that wouldn't normally get along well together are dealing with some of the similar threats, particularly from non-state actors and, you know, terrorist organizations and others. Have there been new diplomatic opportunities that have opened up because of the spread of the dangers of cyber around the world, particularly from, I think, you know, when ISIS was at its height, you saw them attacking everyone, you know, using cyber capabilities that we just not assume existed. You know, yes, this is a problem, but could it also be seen as a diplomatic opportunity?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, cyber threats aren't new, but the issues have definitely presented more and more opportunities over the past decade to, you know, to branch out into new areas of diplomacy. You know, it's an area of diplomacy on its own really now, and you know, it's for engagement with existing close allies and partners, but as you said, on occasion even with adversaries, is either directly. Or in there are other broader fora in which our diplomats are going out and having these exchanges, either at the UN or regional security organizations. More and more these conversations are happening there, trying to help build a global consensus around what we mean by responsible state behavior in cyberspace, because really it affects all of us. And you know, our office, which is just about to become a teenager, we're relatively new when you measure us up against the history of 75 years of INR. But we work regularly with our policy colleagues on some of these diplomatic channels to engage allies and partners and call out the cyber activities of Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. You know, more and more opportunities to do that, obviously. You know, just a few minutes ago, NSA and FBI released a 40-page overview of a previously undisclosed malware used by GRU actors. And that's, you know, one of these, another opportunity in where the IC can help support diplomatic engagements about a shared concern. And so, yeah, the ubiquity, as you said, the ubiquity of cyber threats is opening up new diplomatic opportunities. But it's also, there's a variety of cyber issues that we can engage on. It's not just nation state cybersecurity threats. It's also combating cybercrime. It's non-state actors, as you said. It's protecting human rights online. It's ensuring a multi-stakeholder community remains the foundation of internet governance. It's a host of issues. You know, it's broad and it's deep. So we have lots of work to do.
So Gina, for the hard power folks out there, they might kind of look at what you do and be like, what, you know, what's going on? But your, you know, fiefdom within INR is one of the most important, because understanding kind of what the world is thinking is a key component. And I'm not going to answer the question. I'm going to ask the question for you. But I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward. What are the benefits of doing opinion research around the world? I mean, and the kind of quasi follow up to that is, could this be considered at least an unofficial collection effort? You know, because you are going out and you are actually bringing in data for the IC and data for national security.
Well, okay, so let me, so first of all, I don't call it a fiefdom, I call it an empire.
Yes.
People call me the emperor of polling. I wanna be called the pollster of the United States, which the acronym is POTUS, so taken. So Ellen, I think we should probably work on that.
Got it.
So to answer this, got it? Okay. To answer the second part of the question, it's not collection, it's polling, it's open source research. We've been doing this polling for 75 years since the end of World War II. Most of that time was actually outside of the intelligence community. So we're first part of the Office of Military Government, which was OMG US in Western Germany. And then we were part of the US Information Agency for 50 years. So we were always doing this polling during that time. It wasn't part of the IC, it wasn't collection, it's just polling, which we think is pretty interesting. Anyway, so to answer the broader question, the main national security advantage is really the uniqueness of this information. There are few governments around the world that have the benefit of understanding public opinion to the extent that we do, tailored in the way to their policymakers like we do. So like in any other situation, having unique information gives you this strategic advantage. So some concrete examples, Vince, you talked about influence efforts. Well, this is actually one of the areas where my, Adrian's, Ben's offices really intersect. So on COVID, for instance, this is as much an effort to shape discourse and narratives and control information or to share information as anything else. So my office can go and see what people understand about COVID, see what narratives they're kind of glomming onto. That has a real impact, a real benefit to epidemiology and public health. There is a huge dose of cyber in that, because as Ben mentioned, you know, state actors, other actors are trying to essentially shape narratives and information around COVID. So that's the kind of thing we can only really understand with empirical research. One other thing, we essentially do really good anticipatory intelligence. So with this kind of data, we can say, we think this population is ripe for protests. We can say, this is how this population is probably going to vote. And we are really good at making those predictions. And so those are two really big benefits.
You know, Vince, if I can jump in, because I'll tell you that Regina's heard me say this before. You know, I think I'm so glad that the State Department actually had the foresight to move OPN into the intelligence community. Because it's becoming more and more valuable a tool as the world gets more and more complex, as Gina has just highlighted. And I've actually called it pulled in, because it is a source of information that our all-source analysts absolutely rely on. But I'll tell you, it's also standalone. So if you are in the Bureau of Western Hemispheres and you want to understand how is sanctions working and name the country? You know, there's no better way to do it. There's no more accurate, true way to do it than to get Gina's team on the ground collecting that data and providing those insights. And as I said, in a world that's getting more complex, where it's nothing is black and white, our friends are not our friends and our enemies are not our enemies, you know, having some capability that provides some true insights that can help you sort of, you know, sift the wheat from the chaff, you know, that's OPN. They're an incredibly valuable capability, and they're a very unique tool that INAR has. Another thing that sets us apart from the other intelligence agencies.
Well, Ellen, let me follow up on that, because it's a somewhat exaggeration, but basically the people on the screen is about half of the population of INR. you got put in charge of an organization that is dramatically smaller than many of the other IOC. You have a small team and you have to do way more with way less. Talk a little bit about that dynamic. Is obviously there's a benefit to having, like, you know, 300 kick butt studs at your disposal, but the work, especially in a time like this where you're dealing with a pandemic and there's cyber overtones and there's a lot of information coming in, it's got to be tough to have such a small group working for you.
Well, so first let me start with the benefits of being small. I mean, I've worked at agencies of 15,000 or more, and I think one of the biggest benefits of being small is that we're incredibly agile. So the reality is that we can pivot to a new priority very quickly. And because we're small, we're also very integrated. You know, these three people run three different offices, but they talk and they communicate pretty much daily. And so long before, you know, the rest of the community was moving to a mission management model, whereas we would integrate different skill sets. INR has been doing this for its whole 75 years. So, I mean, that's part of our strength. We work very closely together. Our people are, they tend to stay, they don't tend to leave, and there's a reason why. I mean, having worked defense and law enforcement, let me tell you that working intelligence in support of diplomacy is about as cool as it gets. Because you have a relationship with your client, so you're getting immediate feedback about how that information is actually affecting a policy or how it's not affecting a policy. So there's great, you know, that self-actualization comes from having that sort of relationship, getting that feedback, knowing you're making a difference. And so as a result, because they stay, they get really good at what they're studying. And it can be anything from an operational capability to being an analyst in a China analyst. So, you know, you become pretty good. We speak multiple languages. Most of our people have multiple advanced degrees and they have deep relationships with their clients. So they really, they become friends. They know them. They know the Foreign Service. And so that's why we can do so much with so few people. But the other side of that is not only are we very integrated with the State Department, we're incredibly integrated with the intelligence community. Because we understand the needs of the policymaker, we have people whose entire job it is to ensure that the rest of the intelligence community, those agencies that do collections, are satisfying the needs of the policymaker. They're satisfying the needs of the Secretary of State. And so because we have those relationships and that expertise, we're very successful at being able to leverage the much larger agencies, especially the collection agencies, to make sure that they know that we're here. You know, we're small, but we're mighty. And you ask anybody in the intelligence community, they're gonna tell you that. Okay, so there's the plus side, but here's my public service announcement. The negative side, yes, the world is getting far more complex. You know, we are very proud of our 75-year history. You know, we're the only operational component of the Office of Strategic Services. In 1945, when it was dissolved, there was one capability that remained. That was the Research and Analysis Branch. And President Truman decided to move it to the State Department. So he even wrote in that letter that this is now the first of what will become an enduring intelligence capability in a government entity. When we came over, we were thousands of historians and artists and anthropologists and scientists. And here we are today, not nearly thousands of people in a world that's arguably more complex. And there's a whole host of reasons that we've gotten here, none of which, I'm not blaming the State Department. They're my department. I am incredibly loyal to the state. But it's now we have to be able to identify our requirements and make sure that we really are meeting the president's national security priorities and that we're resourced to do it. And so, you know, I've got a big mouth. I'm willing to communicate what INR is and who we're doing. I appreciate this opportunity to showcase what we're doing because, and by the way, I have the secretary's support on this regard as we really talk about maybe investing in some areas where we need to grow. Areas like emerging technology. So Ben is our director of cyber, and we're very much in the process of giving him another office to lead, and that's an office that looks at emerging tech. You know, what is a world going to look like where artificial intelligence and smart cities are the norm and not the exception? What is the world going to look like when communications are going to be very difficult to get access to because they're encrypted, or we work in a quantum world? What does that look like? What does our policymaker need to understand? How do we operate? And so INR is about being in front of everybody, the policymaker, so we can warn them on what's coming down. And so we can help them understand what's coming across the horizon. And so I'm very much focused during my time at INR at not making us ginormous. It's about maybe bringing in just a couple more folks who can help us with emerging technologies and sanctions support and China. And OPN, which I think is getting, you know, we have more requirements for OPN. We need more scientists. So Adrian is an epidemiologist, but you know, the impact of changes in the environment are real. We need people that understand the climate. So I know I'll stop talking now, but my point is we're small, that's agile, that's a strength, but you know, we need to grow a little bit. And so we need to talk a little bit more about who we are and what our impact is. So that our needs are responded to.
Well, Adrian, let me pick up on that because Ellen talked about a emerging technology department, but let's talk about emerging science because I think that's something that is near and dear to my heart. So I want to hear you talk about it. There used to be, and there still kind of is, but a lot of effort put into scientific attachés in American embassies overseas. There was a program started in the 50s and it got very big in the 60s and then kind of petered out a little bit. Science, because it is universal, there's no such thing as American science and Russian science and Chinese science. You know, it's natural. It's going to happen if it can be discovered. It's discovered by anybody. how active are you in the broader INR and the broader State Department in paying attention to scientific advances worldwide to see perhaps what could be a benefit to the United States, but also what perhaps could be problematic moving into the future to our national security?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that that's really that question you just asked, you know, how in tune are you with the scientific advancements overseas or worldwide? I mean, I would say that's actually the bedrock of my analysis as a health and science analyst in INR. You know, to me, that really comes first and even before, you know, integrating the intelligence reporting, the diplomatic reporting. So that's a key part of the job. And but I, as I kind of mentioned before in my earlier answer, I mean, it's a serious lift, and we are a small bureau. So we try to find ways to do more with less, right? So we do have partners in the IC that do a better job in some ways of more comprehensive analysis, but we absolutely do this. It really is a huge piece of my work. And so, like I said, personally, I have a few strategies, like, you know, keeping relationships with scientists from my prior work, and also making new relationships, and taking advantage of all the programs we have, including analytic outreach, where we're able to bring outside experts in to share their views with us and the policymakers. So yeah, it's a huge piece of the work. There's more than I can do. And as Ellen says, we and I are hoping we'll have some more scientists and emerging tech experts soon, because this is clearly the future, right? So it's super important.
One of the strategies in the past was to make relationships with our scientists, you know, because of before COVID, because of how much international travel was done and how much coordination was done between American scientists and those overseas. Is that still a practice that you do to kind of get a gauge on what's happening around the world?
So you're saying engaging with American scientists in order to keep that finger on the pulse of what's happening?
Right.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, so of course, even though INR, I mean, we are all overt analysts and you know, we don't do any collection and all that kind of thing. I mean, of course, like when it comes to some of the types of interactions and relationships, it's a bit easier to have those. I mean, also just geographically speaking, it's a little bit easier to have the relationships with American scientists, but we're not restricted in that sense. You know, I go to international conferences on epidemiology and public health, and I talk all the time to international scientists. I actually did my PhD in the UK, so I've got quite, you know, a few connections still there, really helpful. I mean, a lot of the European scientists are doing such great work, both in COVID and the suite of all other issues. But yeah, I think it's always easier for us to take advantage of the American scientists who are closer to us. Also the US government, right? We have such a rich resource in the various technical, scientific and technical agencies in the US government. So they're really helpful for this too.
Hey, Vince, so, if I could,
yeah, of course.
The thought from our perspective, as the emerging technology issue has been invoked a few times, you know, I think INR is already in great footing, you know, with emerging technologies. You know, strategic intent is still going to be a key component of that. That's really been our bread and butter for a long time, is you know, when it comes to the question of how quickly can a country move from basic science to applied R&D to achieving operational or strategic advantage, that's where an understanding of the basic science is going to be really important. And that's what Adrian and Ellen already mentioned, that we're building out. And so there's lots of science fellowships that we're relying on to bring in folks who are already at the sort of the postdoc or even tenured faculty level, bringing them in for a time to help inform that, to join that analysis up that INR has been historically so good at. That's merging that strategic intent with sort of emerging understanding of new fields. And that's important to our State Department mission too, because as you said earlier, State Department is everywhere. We operate everywhere. And our national security mission is really broad. It's not just the hard security questions, but it's public health, it's socio-political stability, and things like that. And so that's where we're going. And we have so many sort of pools of knowledge that we can draw from because of how unique INR is. Ellen and Adrian already mentioned a few, and Gina's office obviously is another one.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Well, Gina, let me kick this to you because we talk about complexity, and I think that I believe I kept a pretty good poker face when you brought up polling for voting in elections, but others may have been chuckling because of, you know, our history in the United States, not too great at doing that, at least lately. But we actually have a bit of an advantage here in that there's a pretty binary system in the United States. You got conservatives, Republicans, you know, liberals, Democrats. There's not 57 parties that are involved in elections moving forward, whereas you have insane complexity around the world with diversity of opinions that go far beyond what we see here in the U.S. I mean, I think of, you know, somewhere like Afghanistan, where we've certainly been heavily involved in the last, well, now 20 years or so, with seemingly endless numbers of tribal groups and that see the world in different ways, or even thinking about countries in Europe, our friends in Europe who have true socialist parties and true, you know, far right and true far left. What is the difficulty in the dissemination side of your job to make policymakers understand that it's not just, you know, Republican, Democrat, that there are diversity of opinion that go far beyond what they're used to here?
Yeah, so I might dissent a little bit on the in true fashion on the idea that U.S. opinion is binary. Maybe U.S. political opinion, maybe. Although I would say that there are a lot of tribes within the United States as well, in every country, in every population. In my office, we call them subgroups of a population, right? So for instance, in the United States, you have, yeah, absolutely. You have political parties, then you have urban rural, and you have race, and you have class. And sometimes these things intersect and then they branch off. And that's really interesting when they do. That's what social scientists really love to look at. And frankly, that's what political parties and marketers and businesses and NGOs spend a huge amount of time in the United States researching, giving a lot of resources to micro-targeting infinitely smaller groups. So my point here is that it's the same everywhere. And what social scientists, like the ones in my office, really like to do is understand what you said, understand that complexity. So let's take Afghanistan, for instance. So Afghans think of themselves first and foremost as Afghans, not to say that tribes are not the primary way through the primary lens through which they see the world, certainly not to say that tribes are not essentially how they live their lives. But what's important and what's kind of the case across the board for us is that we're interested, yeah, in those top lines. We're interested, and like anybody in the United States, interested in how, you know, the big picture, the nationwide opinion is. But what's really interesting to us is getting to those subgroups, looking at those divides, looking at why one group says one thing, another group says another thing, and why that matters to US policy. And to go back to the question that you asked, it's complex. Yeah, it's really hard to do. We use a lot of statistical and analytic techniques, a lot of structured analytic techniques to get to that. And then we have to turn that into these narratives that are really accessible, really relatable for policymakers. So yeah, that's hard.
I find it so difficult. I mean, I've asked this question now over the last 6+ years, and I find it difficult to ask without sounding like I'm insulting policymakers. But I mean, the idea is that members of Congress and presidents and others usually don't have a statistical background. They don't necessarily, like Adrian, they don't have a scientific background. They're not necessarily experts on cyber. They're not experts on Afghanistan. They're not experts on a lot of things. And so when it comes to, and maybe this is also a question for Ellen as kind of the clearinghouse and the conduit for this information, you know, you're bringing in your case, Gina, you're bringing in thousands and thousands and thousands of individual points of data about opinion around the world. And then you have to find a way to tell Congressperson X or, you know, Secretary of State Pompeo or someone who might be a lawyer by training or might be a, you know, member of Congress, why this information matters. And to me, INR actually has one of the harder jobs because you're not necessarily doing the traditional stuff that, you know, CIA says Russia's got a new tank or DIA says Russia's got a new tank. It's hard to kill. This is why we should be worried about it. Or the Chinese economy is looking great in 10 years, you know, thank you, Treasury Department. But when we talk about polling, you're talking about relationships between countries, you're talking about science and international pandemics, these might not be things that are known all that well or understood all that well. So the dissemination that probably sounds like it's meant to be more difficult than for others.
If I, you know, Gina, if I can jump on this, because I'll tell you that I think that's a great question, especially now, given sort of the environment we're operating in. But the reality is that, yeah, support, I mentioned this earlier, intelligence support to policy is very different than intelligence support to defense or law enforcement. Mm-hmm. You know, who's behind the door? What kind of a tank that is that? You know, what satellite is what? This is much different. And so so policymakers, they use a lot of different data to establish a policy. And intelligence is but one stream of data of many that the secretary or the congressman or the assistant secretary is going to use when they establish a policy. Turn that off. And so there's lots of times where, you know, intelligence is going here, not very well. The intelligence is over here and policy is over here. So, you know, so it is hard to be the intel analyst at state who's got to go to the policymaker and says, this is where you are, but this is what I'm seeing. And so you really have to see, you really have to understand about how can I deliver that information in a way that is useful and is going to be informative. How do I inform that policy? And there is a bit of an art to that, and there's lots of different ways that it happens. You know, probably the best way is because of these relationships that we have. You know, we're very close relationships. We meet with them every day. We sit down and talk. We're sharing emails. We're sharing. So that's one way to do it. It may be a product. It may be in the president's daily briefing. So, you know, we are the number one producer of the president's daily brief per capita of our other two all-source intelligence agencies. And that's because we truly understand what the policymaker wants and cares about. So we have a whole pantheon of ways that we can disseminate this information. And it is tough because lots of times it's not what they want to hear. I laugh because 75 years ago, when we were coming to state, I've heard that State Department didn't want the research and analysis branch because they said things that the policymakers didn't always want to hear. I think that's, you know, we're very proud of that tradition on some level because that is providing a service, providing truth to power. We come up with ways to share it. We also understand that it's not always going to be considered, that there's other sources of data that's going to be considered, and we keep going. I'm confident that we provide value because I will tell you that we are asked for all the time and nobody ever says no to an INR analyst walking in the door and saying, this is what we think. Our secretary is an avid consumer of intelligence. He asks thousands of questions all day long. The deputy secretary of state, we meet with him 2 or 3 times a day, avid consumer of intelligence. The bureaus, the undersecretaries and the assistant secretaries and the posts, are always asking for more. So for me, I know we're providing value because more times than not, intelligence actually is affecting policy. Okay. And it's our intelligence that's affecting that policy.
Yeah, you're welcome, Ellen, to answer this or not answer it because it is a little bit about inside baseball and about the boss, but the Secretary of State is a former CIA director. And how much do you think that's kind of affected his thirst for intelligence and kind of the way that he approaches INR?
He is, I will tell you that He is an avid consumer of intelligence. And you know, I suspect he was that way when he went to CIA. I'm sure that CIA just, further, inflamed that lust for more and more intelligence and questions. And, he is incredibly fast and he puts together concepts very, very quickly. In fact, he and I have a bet right now that, I want to be able to get something to him from INR before he's had a chance to ask the question. And I think I've won, but I'm not going to ask him that. But the point is that it's fun working for a boss who's like that. There's times that we've worked for people over the course of my career where intelligence is but one source of information. For our leadership team, INR is very much valued and very much a part of what they do. And, I'm happy to see how our support actually impacts policy.
So Ben, I saved this question for last before we kick it to the audience, because it's just a juicy kind of waxing philosophic question. I'm a diplomatic historian, so I've been studying diplomacy and going all the way back to its early history. And for hundreds of years, there's been at least a basic understanding of what an act of war constituted. Like, you invade somebody, you blow up something, you kill a leader, it's an act of war. Cyber's kind of flipped that on its head. I mean, we're in a position where there have been actual kinetic attacks using cyber. There obviously have been meddling in elections using cyber. We've done certainly things to other countries within covert action that could at one point be constituted as problematic, if not an act of war. How closely are we, meaning your department, INR writ large, working with our allies on the diplomatic intelligence side to somehow codify what an act of war in the cyber realm might look like? Where are we drawing lines, or are we just still trying to figure it out as we go along?
Your intellectual curiosity as an historian is well placed in this question. It's a great question, and I need my my handlers would have me say first that I'm not a government lawyer, so I want to put that out there. But I would note, and you cite some great examples. I would note though that the majority, overwhelming majority of cyber incidents and malicious activity that we work on, including state-sponsored cyber activity, it doesn't manifest in physical violence or a physical outcome. And in many ways, the biggest challenge we work on and work with every day is that it's more analogous to other types of competition between states. It's much more, the activity is more like espionage and information operations. And there's a case to be made, really, that states are deliberately staying away below the threshold of violence, precisely because they understand that such an effect would provoke a very different kind of response from a victim state. So, in legal terms, we say that the range of activities that we mostly see fall below the threshold of use of force or armed attack, and that states understand that a use of force is still unlawful, international law still applies, and that victim states have an inherent right to self-defense. And so again, the challenge is that cyber presents not so much novel ways of acts of war, but that states can cause a lot of economic damage. They can cause a tremendous amount of inconvenience in a state that falls below what's traditionally understood as a use of force or an armed attack. So, and it doesn't help that there's less consensus around when international law might prohibit this kind of activity. And so, yes, the diplomats that we support, whether they be in L or our cyber policy colleagues, they are working really hard to help codify some of this. So, those questions are being discussed at the UN's the GGE, the group of government experts, at the OEWG, the Open Ended Working Group. In these fora, the US has publicly shared its views as to when a cyber operation might constitute a use of force or armed attack. And in the past year or two or so, I'd say, more and more states are sharing their views too. And as we get to greater transparency, that's when we might get a little more predictability and stability in cyberspace. And that's what our colleagues are working on.
Yeah, we've been somewhat open, and certainly our Western European friends have been open about, hey, look, if you shut down the East Coast of the United States, we might not take that as something we're just going to say, okay, nice job. But there are certain states' potential adversaries who haven't been as open. Are we in a position where we need that openness, to try to to mitigate, kind of going back to kind of the nuclear age, right? You always wanted people to know where your red line was, right? Don't step over the red line or the missiles start flying. Do we need a international understanding of where the cyber red line is?
I can't say it wouldn't help. They're obviously, you know, as the strategic planners will also talk about strategic ambiguity and uses there. But you know, there are these conversations. There is an effort to get greater transparency here. We are talking to governments that we are concerned about some of their malicious activity, and so I can't say I'm not privy to those discussions. We're not there, but I can say that they're certainly important.
All right, Amanda, let's bring you back on and let's see what our audience has as far as questions are concerned. I try to give us enough time because I'm thinking there's going to be some questions.
There definitely are. This is not the first one that I would have started with, but because you were in the international collaboration realm, this one makes really great sense. Wondering, how do we collaborate with our friends but not overshare? How do you juggle that fine line?
How do we share? How do we collaborate with? Are you talking about an international?
Yes. How do you share information but not overshare too much? How do you handle that?
Well, I'll tell you from an intelligence perspective, we are one of the 16 intelligence agencies. And so that's very much a part of our training, our trade craft, how we work. I will tell you that we have very close partnerships. I'm sure you've heard this from other speakers that date back to the beginning of the intelligence community. But we very much understand, you know, what can be shared and what can't be shared. And our partners do as well. I mean, so with some relationships, they're much more transparent. With others, not quite as much. But we understand where those, you know, we know what the requirements are. We know what is shareable and what is not shareable. We understand the clearance process. But, you know, let me tell you that we have great partnerships, great friendships, and derive great benefit and value. When I talked about how small we are, it's not just the U.S. intelligence community, the national security framework that we leverage, but it very much is our international partners and our international friends. And working for a department that's focused on diplomacy, we have a lot of those. So that's another area where we bring some unique perspective.
I'm going to roll two questions into one. One person wants to know, how would a university student who's interested in a career with INR or in the intelligence community, how would they get moving? And so tied to that, one of our former colleagues wants to know a little bit more about your individual career paths. Were you external hires? Did you come up through the ranks? If you're willing to share anything about your own personal journeys.
I think we should start with the group. I mean, I'm looking at Adrian. Adrian, you started as a fellow, and that was how you got your entree. Every one of the folks here have a very interesting story about how they got in. So I'm going to turn it over to my colleague.
Sometimes I worry it's tough to give advice because I think everyone has this maybe eccentricities in their pathway. So I'm a scientist by training. So I was in scientific research for a number of years. I did a PhD in epidemiology. I was actually working in the private sector, and I decided to pursue a AAAS Science and Technology Policy Fellowship. So that's designed to bring PhDs into federal government service. And, you know, I didn't even know what INR was. So I don't really even know what to tell somebody, to be honest, because, you know, I just had that interview and thought it was the coolest thing ever and just kind of took a chance on it. And that was over 6 years ago, and I'm still here. So that's my story.
What about you, Ben?
So for me, yeah, I think everyone has a circuitous route to the seats in which we sit. Mine is no different. So I was wrapping up my doctoral work on Chinese politics and international relations. Wasn't sure where to apply that knowledge and research, but I did know about INR, and I was fortunate when I was accepted into the Presidential Management Fellowship Program. That they, you know, a lot of its timing, a lot of its persistence, but a job opened up and I applied for it. So I had done lots of my doctoral work on non-state actors in China and international relations involved there. And so INR had questions about non-state actors in China. And so it was, a lot of it was timing, and I knew I wanted to be there. And then from there, questions about non-state cyber actors started to populate. And then the story continued as I said yes to every opportunity that came my way. And now here I am just looking more broadly at cyber issues.
And then for me, I was also a PMF. So, you know, it's not, I think people should be aware of programs like that, the Boren Fellowship, the Presidential Management Fellowship. Those are great ways into government service in general. I would say, so I started as a PMF, and I started actually in my office as an analyst on Russia and Ukraine. Worked my way up, and lo and behold, now I'm the director. But I would say that for my big advice, and this might be a little self-serving, is quantitative social science plus area expertise. Those two things together can parlay into so many things. Either one, both together, like we do in my office, it's just, I mean, those are two skill sets that will serve people really well who are in university. So that's what I would suggest.
I came in on a different path. I started at a place called the Institute for Defense Analysis, which is a federally funded research and development corporation, as an intern. And I was working on a paper that involved working with naval intelligence. And in the process of working on that paper, I was actually picked up by the Office of Naval Intelligence. And so, you know, there's multiple routes to get into the intelligence community. I think we've got three examples of where fellowships are great. I will say that, you know, looking at internships, also looking at the private sector is an entree to government service. So, you know, the intelligence community gets a lot of support from the private sector and companies that provide not only technical support, but analytic support. And so that's a great way to provide to get access to the IC. I'll tell you that most of the agencies have numerous job fairs. I would go to an agency website and I would see what's going on. But I will tell you that what hasn't changed, and this is a bit frustrating for me, is that what's not changed since 1988, it's not only what you know, but it is your network. And so to the extent you take advantages of things like what you're doing right now and making those relationships, working your network, because that's really the best way to get in. It's if you have somebody who's inside who says, I know this person, you know, she is brilliant at this. That is very helpful to eventually getting into the intelligence community, or working on the private sector side. We're working very hard at INR. We're one of the last agencies that we don't hire directly right now. So what I would say is keep an eye on the State Department, on OPM and State Department. We actually are hiring a number of positions, but we follow a traditional hiring route. But I would say definitely take advantage of your network and make some phone calls.
All right, so here is it's someone who has a great perspective on INR's analysis, and said it has stood out from the rest of the intelligence community in accurate analysis regarding events such as the Vietnam War, the Yom Kippur War, and Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. We had an exhibit called Weapons of Mass Destruction. It always messes me up. Sorry. Weapons of Mass Destruction. So what makes INR stand out in this regard and have such solid analysis?
So I get it goes to our history. Vince, you're a historian. You know, when I talked about OSS and Wild Bill Donovan, he recruited folks that were really smart who could win at bar fights. I mean, that was his measure. And so, you know, a little scrappy, incredibly smart. And so being deep in an area and having those relationships with your client enables you to gain insights that you might not get if you're only working in an area for 2 to 3 years. So by comparison, some of the other all-source agencies They provide great intelligence support, but they've got a different operating model. So you'll have people who are highly specialized because they're so big, they'll be highly specialized in a very small area. Or they may rotate, they may be more generalists and they'll rotate to other sides. So we, on the other hand, have deep expertise on things that are relevant to the policymaker. And so we get a little bit different perspective on that. And so when we're working joint intelligence products, you know, we come in with a different view. And I'll tell you that I think that's a view, and it's part of our culture. You know, I talked about where we were 75 years ago. We take great pride. Gina mentioned that I'm going to disagree with you on something. That's part of who we are. And I think as a result, we provide great value to the intelligence community and the national security sector as a result. You know, you hear about the things that you hear about. You talk about INR going a little bit under the radar. We're very comfortable in that place. Every day we provide dissents to pieces, or we support a certain piece. And it doesn't get heard about, and that's what we like. So we don't, you know, while I want to tell our story, I really don't want to be too specific, because we want to provide, we want to continue to provide the best support that we can to our policy colleagues.
Can I jump in and ask the question? In a lot of these large bureaucracies, I won't name names, but you know, large agencies that are much more populous than INR, there is a somewhat fear of going against the grain and perhaps not getting promoted because of it, or you know, not taking chances because if you're wrong, that could end a career. Do you kind of create an environment, or is it traditional within INR to have that environment of risk reward? The idea is, look, if you're wrong, people are wrong. It's not going to end your career. Like, can you go and be different because you have the ability to screw up, or you're not so afraid of messing up that you're willing to go out on a limb?
Well, again, I think that gets to the small, you know, that for folks who come to INR, they tend to stick around. For them, self-actualization is being a part of the policy process. And with that comes great reward. You know, it's funny, all the data shows that, you know, promotions are great. Don't get me wrong. We have to support our families. We have to have a life. But at the end of the day, you know, most of the folks in government and at INR, you know, they derive incredible benefit from having that relationship and from having that impact. And I think that's one thing that does set INR apart from the other agencies. I'll tell you, that's one thing I'm also worried about, though, is we're new generation, new challenges. The world is changing. It's far more complex. So I'm very much focused on what are the things can I and the leadership team do to encourage our people to stay? You know, I want them to be able to get opportunities to work in other agencies, to work at embassies, and then to come back with that knowledge and to provide them opportunities for promotion and opportunities to get other experiences. You know, I'm very focused on what can we do to keep our workforce. That may be different than some of the other agencies, but that really is where our value derives from.
And can I just jump in here? I want to say that Ellen's been bragging about us the whole time, but I think some of these questions you're asking also point to the strength and leadership we have. We've got Ellen, but also lots of the other deputy assistant secretaries and, you know, my boss and office director. And there really is a culture of trust in the experts, trust in expertise. And so for us as analysts, we have the backing of our leadership when we want to make a call. And you might call it high risk, but I would say it's actually not very high risk because they are hiring the experts and they trust us. And yes, of course, sometimes we get it wrong and that's okay, right? We make probabilistic assessments anyway. So we always leave a little room to get it wrong. But I would just say that leadership culture of trust in the analysts and you know, really being behind us all the time contributes to that. It's also a motivator for excellence. I mean, I can say for me personally, I mean, you come in and you're ready for the president's daily brief, you know, not the day you arrive, but, you know, pretty early on, and you're given a lot of responsibility because we are small. And to me, that just makes us all want to do better.
I think you guys will enjoy clarifying this question since we don't have much time left, but people want to know if you're asked to generally find information on a subject or to find information from a specific political point of view.